On this episode of Agency Exits, I talked with Daryl Hively, who has a fantastic model. It is a wholesale retail model of running an agency. And whether or not you want to use this model, I think he's got a lot of lessons for how you can think about delivering operations and how to set yourself up for a successful sale. So let's dive in. Hi, Raj Jha here with Agency Exits, where we talk with agency owners about their path to growth and exit and the lessons learned. I'm here with Daryl Hively, who has created an agency and sold an agency with a really interesting model that I think not a lot of people think about, but they should think about it, either in terms of taking their agency in that direction or in terms of employing an agency like this. So, Daryl, thanks for joining me today.
Hey, happy to be here. I love the work you're doing.
That's awesome. So let's talk a little bit about your agency. Maybe just give me the quick notes about how you started it and the focus of the agency. And then I think there's a whole bunch of things that we can dive into about the details of this, which I find really fascinating. So maybe let's paint the picture about how you got into it and how you grew it. And then we'll get into all the good stuff there.
Yeah, well, if we can go way back in time to like 2009, okay, I was working for a media company and I convinced the powers that be to create a new division to create a digital agency within a larger media company. So this was a TV, radio, newspaper company that wanted to add a fourth stream of revenue. So we did that and right away we had new clients, new revenue, and I realized this might be something I could take and work with the rest of the media industry with. So I launched a company called Guaranteed Digital. And we were the white label agency behind, it ended up being close to 300 different agencies around the US. So folks in their local markets, and in many cases, these were media companies, but we ended up working with agencies of all types, not just media related. But they would go out and sell, you know, their local car dealer, a PPC campaign. We would do the fulfillment on the back end. So this allowed a lot of folks to go to market with digital agency services without having to hire all the headcount. And as you know, sometimes you get ahead of yourself, you get all that labor cost before you have the actual revenue to support it. So it was a perfect model because a lot of these folks already had salespeople, and with some training, they could go out and pitch these digital programs, and then we would do the work on the back end. So for them, it really helped them sort of monitor and make sure that their expenses were in sync with their revenue, that they weren't getting ahead of themselves with hiring a room full of web developers or a room full of Google experts, for example. So that was the business. And just in the last 18 months, I exited and ended up selling it to a large media company. And so it was a great ride and I learned a lot.
That's great. So I am really curious about this because my agency, I did everything myself, right? So the probably the wrong way in your world, right? And I'd hire people. Sometimes I have freelancers part-time until I could get enough revenue to hire a person into that role. Now, your model is very different because your client is not the end client. Your client is the agency. So first of all, was this the model from the get-go, or did you turn it into this model from a more traditional, for lack of a better word, agency?
Yeah, no, I knew that one of my biggest assets, when you think about what are all the things that you have that you could monetize, was my connections in the industry, because I had been in the industry for years. And I knew guys like me working in other markets that were trying to figure this out. And so in the first year, we added like 25 partners. And we just took off from there. But I know taking my own advice, drinking my own Kool-Aid, one of my learnings early on was don't try to do it all yourself, because we were very lean early on. And if I could have probably got, who knows how much farther and faster we would have gone if we would have added more of the right people in certain roles. And I'm talking sort of management roles, strategic roles that can lead departments and lead sales teams. You know, sometimes owners and founders think they know everything and they don't.
And the interesting thing is that's always the hire that you think you can't afford, because you think, oh, I'll just go longer with me in the captain's chair and I'm going to hire a whole bunch more of the more junior folks to actually do delivery. And then the middle is really thin for a really long time. And then when you finally get up the the guts if it were to hire that middle level. You're like, oh, wow, my life just got so much easier and I'm freed up mentally and my calendar is freed up to actually do some more growth. So I think it's a really interesting thing that that's the most expensive feeling hire. And it's also the biggest return hire in the middle management.
Yeah, it really is. And when you go down to the scale of a local agency, so someone just starting their own agency, they often are in that position, you know, and so we let them take advantage of our expertise. And I still say we, even though it's not mine anymore, and let them do what they're really good at, which typically is client relationships, strategy. They don't need to get their hands in the weeds. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, how do you think about selling in that context when, you know, it's a wholesale model I'm using your word, right? Wholesale retail model. It's not my vocabulary. So I'm going to use your vocabulary that you taught me. So the wholesale model, how do you think about selling? Because they're partner agencies. They're the ones that are going out and getting the business but you're selling to them. How do you think about a sales context when it is selling an agency and they're a reseller in a way versus getting your own client?
Right. Now, most of our partners we were on an agreement with. So there was at minimum a monthly retainer that they owed us. And it was small, it was manageable. But as I got into the talking to brokers and getting ready to sell the business, I realized that another thing I wish I'd done is had more of that MRR, that monthly recurring revenue that was locked in, because that's how many of these folks will really value, you know, your company. But to compensate for that, they looked at our customer base of an army of salespeople out there in the U.S. working for all these different resellers, and that certainly had value. They could look at our trailing 12-month EBITDA. I mean, there was a lot of good numbers for them to look at, but we probably, unlike an agency selling locally that may be doing lead gen or offering some sort of service that has a fixed monthly recurring revenue piece, you know, we didn't quite have that.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So it wasn't, so you didn't necessarily have retainers with all of your agency clients. It was more, I guess, the piecework, right? It's like as they need something, they come to you versus getting them on a retainer that says, I'm doing all the PPC work for one of your clients regularly. Is that right?
Yeah. You know, again, there was a minimum monthly commitment so that they weren't selling X, they were going to get a bill, right? Mm-hmm. So that sort of kept them focused, right? Because they knew they needed to go sell something this month and they're going to get a bill anyways. But for our really big partners, it was never an issue. They were out hustling and selling. And, you know, it just ended up being the only thing you don't have control of in the wholesale retail environment is how hard the retailer's working to sell.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't like a sales team you could bring into the office and yell at them and say, hey, I'm going to cut your commissions if you don't sell more. You know, I mean, these guys were your partners. So we had to lead them rather than use a stick. You know, we had to educate them and help them and constantly bring them new products and new ideas and provide training. Mm-hmm. And we had on-call sales support. We did a lot of things to help our partners sell more.
Got it. I want to frame this for anyone watching. And you're like, oh, I don't want to be a wholesaler. However, I think a lot of what we're going to talk about here is going to be useful to you if you ever think about bringing on a partner who is a fulfillment partner of yours, which is a solution that you could be thinking about. So just going to encourage anyone listening that this is twofold. It can be both I'm delivering on this model or I am using this model with someone else doing the delivery. So with that said, Daryl, I'm interested in when you have a partner, what did you do successfully to help them sell? I mean, you talked about the sales enablement model. And then if someone is using a model like with a wholesaler and they're an agency and getting a wholesaler, then how should they think about what to expect from a good partner on the sales process?
The first question, and believe me, I've talked to so many agencies looking for a white label partner, and this is the conversation. It usually goes something like, number one, ask them about the account support you're going to get after the sale. You make a big sale, you book the order, then what happens? And that is where sales are won or lost, is how smooth the onboarding process is. And are there real human beings based here in the States, in your time zone, that can hop on calls with your customers? Because there are a number of white label partners out there that will give you a marketplace of products But once you pick a product and sell it, you end up doing a lot of the heavy lifting yourself as far as fulfillment. So it's nice to have a product offer, but if you need to do all the data entry and all the work needed to get whatever it is up and running, it's a little bit defeating. It's not as good as it could be. So number one, make sure that the account support is there. And the other thing that we've already touched on is the sales support. So we supported our customers before they even made a sale. We gave them sales collateral. We gave them training. We had a proposal builder so they could enter in details of their client. It would generate a recommendation. We provided reporting. So after the sale, they had a great reporting dashboard to demonstrate the ROI to the customer. So all of those things help them not only make the sale, but keep it sold. And again, those account managers would jump on monthly strategy calls, go over the numbers, make sure everybody was comfortable with what was happening.
So it really is thinking of it as a partnership versus as a vendor. I mean, I know it is a vendor relationship, but very often it is the, can I throw it over the transom to somebody else and they're just going to handle it and go away versus integrating more closely. And that's a theme that I see with any kind of outsourcing or even folks who get offshore teams, build offshore teams. I built an offshore team and it is very common for people to think, oh, there's just a human robot over there. And I'm just going to throw a piece of work back and throw a piece of work there and I get it back, instead of thinking of how do I actually integrate them as if they were in the same office. So I think there's a big mentality shift there. How do you view that?
Yeah, no, we always referred to our resellers as partners, because it was totally in our best interest to help them any way we could to make more sales. And whether it was training, whether it was sales ideas. I remember when COVID hit, we had a standing Wednesday webinar for any partner who wanted to dial in and listen. And we were just constantly brainstorming ideas that they could go out and talk to businesses about, even when it felt the world was in lockdown. And we got some of our best sort of reviews and attaboys from that. People were like, when some of our partners just disappeared when COVID hit. And you guys were right there with us trying to figure out ways to make money. And so it was, that kind of relationship, folks will forgive you when you screw up every now and then because they know that you have the bigger picture in mind.
Let me change gears a little bit and talk about your operations, because when you are in a wholesale model, operational excellence really matters, whether it is templatizing all your processes, et cetera, because if you're not offering something that's more or less a product, if it's bespoke for every client, it's harder for you to price and it's harder for you to scale. So talk to me a little bit about how you thought about that, because I think regardless of whether someone is on your model or another, you must have had a lot of operational excellence to do this well. So I'm sure there are a lot of lessons to be learned there. Maybe pick a couple examples about how you thought about that and how you used operational excellence for delivery.
Well, sort of the beauty of what we were doing with all these different partners, we worked with a lot of different verticals. So home services is a perfect example. Roofers. We, had lots of roofers. And over time, we got to realize here's what works the best for a roofer. Now, you can come up with a new shiny object that maybe they want to try. But the thing is, we want to work on the foundational stuff that's going to make your phone ring and book business, right? And so we would really sort of hone that process in and make sure that when a partner brought us a new roofer or anybody really in that category, we knew exactly what to do and we could repeat it over and over again. And, one of the things I learned, and my team would get on me about it because I'm a sales and marketing guy, right? I love new stuff. And so I was always, and it's something we promised our partners too. Let us be your biz dev team. We're going to find out what's new and what's next, and you can put it into your product mix. So there were times over the years where I would bring something new to the team and they would rip it apart and tear it down. And I go, okay, maybe that's not such a good idea after all. But you got to be experimenting and testing, because that's one thing we know about this world of digital. It just constantly evolves and changes. And so the products you had even 6 months ago or a year ago, you continually need to be improving on those because the world is moving quick.
Yeah. And how did you think about documenting those procedures and processes, right? So you've got a general PPC process, but then there's some nuances for a roofer versus an HVAC company. How did you do that? And who in your team was in charge of building it? managing it, and then making sure that the KPIs were tracked.
Yeah, so we used Basecamp as our project management platform and a way to document everything we were doing. And it was great because it was transparent. Clients could see, our reseller partners could see, even at the client level, the end retail client, they could see a certain bit of information in there. So it also allowed us to communicate white label with people because we did it through Basecamp. So we didn't have to juggle 250 email addresses. We just did it through Basecamp. But each of the departments, whether it was the web team, the marketing team, the social team, you know, they did a great job of documenting what they were doing in keeping it all organized in Basecamp. So we were able to sort of keep track of everything. And if somebody moved on, whether it was an account manager or a department head or whatever, that information obviously stayed with us.
Mm-hmm. Great. Let's talk a little bit about the acquisition process. First, what led you to start thinking about getting acquired? So you've been at it for a while, have a bunch of success. You got hundreds of clients at this point. What was the triggering thing that's like, I got to be thinking about this? Or did it just land in your lap, kind of like it did for me?
Yeah, you know, I had had people reaching out, sort of inquiring, and really, we, you know, after COVID, that drumbeat really picked up. There was just a lot of people looking to get into the space. And so we initially had people reaching out, and then a couple of misfires, you know, a couple of things that it's another thing you got to be careful of as a founder looking to do that exit is not to take your eye off the ball of the main business while you're excited about trying to put something together and get out. So, but we finally, and I'll mention them by name, there's a group called Barney, and they, barney.com, look them up. And it's not the purple dinosaur that if you have little kids, you might remember.
That would be an interesting acquisition partner.
Yeah. They specialize in helping digital agencies get sold. They're a broker in that space. That is their very, and they were great. I mean, they put a prospectus together. And again, this was after a couple of misfires with some people that weren't, ended up, we didn't do the deal. But within a week of the initial prospectus going out to their list, because they have a pretty deep list of interested buyers, I had four LOIs submitted. So we had letters of intent from people interested in taking the next step. And so that was a great position to be in because we could look at each of those four partners. Who would we rather end up with? And we were able to move forward that way.
That's great. So you move forward with one of those four. So it was not somebody that you knew beforehand. But you knew that I want to start this process. And then that person, your buyer came in through the process.
Yeah. Yeah. And because we'd been down the road with a couple other potential buyers before, we had all of our financials in order. We had everything. We had the numbers ready to share, you know, and so we had sort of got ready, you know, cleaned things up, made sure that all of our books were up to date.
Great. And tell me a little bit about the diligence process, because that's always something that varies a lot based on how prepared you are. It sounds like you've gone through one or two, you know, false starts on that. But depending on who the acquirer is, and you're acquired by, you know, an older company, let's say a more mature company, which sometimes, you know, I don't want to characterize this as always happening, but sometimes they got the older school lawyers who are going to, like, you know, take it to the nth degree when doing diligence. How did yours go, and what do you wish that you might have done differently to prepare for it?
It actually happened in about 4 months. Sometimes these things really drag out. It went pretty quickly. We knew of each other. The people at the table, one of the lead folks on their side was someone I'd known for years in the industry. He just wasn't an existing partner at the time. Mm-hmm. And so there was a comfort level there in that they knew we knew their business because we'd been working with media companies for almost 11 years at that time. So they knew we understood their business. And so there was that sort of relationship that pre-existed. We knew their business. And then what they really wanted to dig into was just, okay, who are your customers? How are you making your money? Who are these folks that will soon be our customers? And once they got a look at that list, realized we had some good partners. And there were some interesting pre-existing relationships even within those partners with the acquiring company. So, and again, that's not always going to happen, but that's the way it worked out this time. And the other thing, I think it was a strategic fit for them. Sometimes people are adding just to add top line revenue, but for them internally, for their own business, they wanted to plug in some of our services to help them make money internally. So this just wasn't an acquisition to add to top line revenue. It solved a problem that they had within their company as well.
It's interesting. I've talked to a number of owners on this podcast about a strategic acquisition and how it is fundamentally different because they're not just viewing it as just the math of the business. There's the little kicker that you get because there's like, ooh, okay, we're getting a service department that we would otherwise have to build, and it would take us a year or two to build this thing. And instead, we get not just a few people that we could get, but because there's this entire organization around there, they already get the redundancy. They already get the skill set and the knowledge, which fast forwards them a lot. So that's not to be underestimated in my thinking.
Yeah, no, it was. And again, it made them, when I looked at all the other potentials, the other LOI, they were the best fit for a lot of that reason.
Tell me about your team in the transition. When did you tell them? How did they take it? And how did that transition work right after the acquisition?
Yeah, so we had been through an exercise once before where we had a buyer that didn't end up working out, came in, and I had our management team up to speed. I go, guys, mm-hmm. Here's what's happening. Here's why this is an opportunity for all of us and why it could be good for you as well as for my family and the company overall. So they were bought in, and we got to do a dog and pony for one potential buyer came into our offices. And so it was a great exercise. So they knew, and that was probably 6 or 9 months before we ended up doing this other deal, they knew that was going on. And so when they saw that the next buyer, who they were, how big they were, they realized that it was, don't go anywhere. This is going to be a good opportunity. And for key, a couple key personnel, we made sure there was a nice bonus for them to stick around. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, which brings up an interesting thought, which is sometimes owners of agencies are afraid that the staff is going to flee if they hear that the business is being sold. On the other hand, depending on the nature of that staff, they may prefer the certainty of a larger company, right? Because an agency has its ups and its downs. And, you know, even up until $10, $15 million in revenue, you sometimes don't know how it's going to go and if there's going to be certainty there. But you get acquired by a $100 million company, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, okay, now this feels realer, even though for the entrepreneur, it's the opposite. For the staff, may feel differently. So I think that's not to be underestimated.
Yeah. And that's certainly the way we positioned it. And so that gave them some comfort. And, you know, not that they ever worried that they were going to get their paycheck every other week, but it was nice knowing that, just as you said, that certainty of a larger organization.
Yeah. So tell me about your transition. Like, how did that go? And how did your day-to-day life change from the day that the deal is inked and then you start your kind of your earnout period, your transition period? How did that look? Because I think one of the things that's a big question mark and a mystery to a lot of agency owners, some think I sign on the dotted line, I get a check, and I would just walk away. And that is rarely the case. There's I know like one person who was able to do that. There usually is an earnout period. There usually is this period, and I had this as well, where you're intimately involved with the business. Talk to me a little bit about like what that looked like for you and how that felt different from when you were running the show.
It was this huge, it's just the relief. But all that hard work, those 60, 80 hour work weeks and Saturday mornings in the office, all that stuff goes, you know, just mm-hmm. that sense of relief and satisfaction. So that was first. But then it sort of transitioned into your part advisor. And the other role I had was continuing with business development. So mm-hmm. I was just there to say, hey, if you do this is what could happen, and trying to help make the transition smooth for everyone. But I no longer had to worry about HR issues. I didn't have to worry about AP and AR and all that fun stuff. And so really, I just continued doing what I was doing, talking about the agency, because they left it as a standalone division. Mm-hmm. So continued to find new partners who want to take advantage of our white label services. And I was happy to do that. It was my favorite part of the job. I could do that standing on my head. So that was what I did during the transition, and it worked out well.
Great. And how was your earnout structured? Was it a big chunk of the payment, or was it just a small piece? Was it milestone-based, time-based? How did that work?
Yeah, it was just a 12-month, they held back 10%.
Oh, okay.
I got that after 12 months.
So really small amount. That's a shockingly small amount.
Yeah. And then I was on an employment contract with them for a certain amount of months, and I got paid a nice sum to do that. And so that was just an extra gift I got for, you know, doing it pretty much. It was pretty easy for me, but it just allowed me to be thinking during that time also what's next, you know, so that, that was fun. And it ended recently.
Yeah. And so you now are thinking what's next, and you have that kind of freedom to do so.
Yeah, it is. And because we were in Milwaukee, of all frozen places to live, and we relocated down to Florida. So I'm sitting here in my office looking out over the bay, and my boat's hanging out back. But, you know, you can only fish so many hours a day. But my brain is still working on what's next. And it's fun because I think we're getting into something I really like. And it's probably not surprising. It's in the area of AI. And it's in the area of helping businesses do better following up on their leads. For 30 some years, I've been in advertising, and we could lead a horse to water, right? We could drive traffic. We could make phone ring. We could fill up the lead forms. But what does the sales team on the other end do with those leads? So what we're working on now is a service to help business owners better convert their leads using conversational AI, where it sounds like you're talking to a real human, and you never have to worry about somebody calling in sick again. You never have to worry about your staff having some drama in the household, distracting them from their job. You can turn the AI loose, and then your salespeople will be working more bona fide leads. So anyways, that's right. what I'm looking at now, but it's kind of exciting.
That's very exciting, because that's the trouble that I faced constantly with my agency. We get them leads, and then they would say, where are the leads? And we say, well, we sent you 75 leads this month. And they're like, well, we got one client. And then I have to go and have someone mystery shop them and realize that someone isn't picking up the phone for seven rings. And when they do, it's just a cursory, you know, we worked at a legal firm. So it's like law office. That's not how you answer the phone. They were just leaking money out the back end. And when you fix the phones, then it's like, oh, okay, well, those 75 leads, they turn into 30 good prospects. But big problem. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's the approach we're looking at right now is to go to these businesses and say, look, let's look at 2023. You probably have a database of leads that have just gone cold. Whatever reason, your reps weren't able to convert them. They're probably not even calling these folks back. Let me turn my AI loose on this, and we'll reinvigorate that database and get some new appointments on the books for your team. And you won't owe us any money until you start selling stuff.
Mm-hmm.
When would you like to get started?
You know, that's the mafia offer. The offer you can't refuse.
Right. What you mean? I just have to give you an Excel spreadsheet, and you're gonna, you know. So
that's great.
That's what we're looking at right now, and I just think it's so needed.
And I love the fact that you can take that experience, and a lot of us take experience to start the agency, right? I mean, we have got some connections, some skills. You just start the agency, and then you leapfrog that, and you say, okay, well, now I'm done with the agency, or I'm spinning out something from the agency. And you take that and go into the next thing. So I love the fact that you're able to play with something super fun.
Yeah, it's fun. And it's more of that MRR we were talking about. It's more of almost the software as a service. If we're not selling advertising, I don't want to do your Google ads. I just want to help you convert your leads. It syncs nicely. And who knows, it may become a white label offering once again when we go back out to our partners. But for right now, we're going to give it a test run locally and generate some direct sales and see how it goes.
Fantastic. Good. As we wrap up, I'd love to hear, to start out with, what are a few of the things that you wish you'd known before the sales process? So think earlier on in your agency career, you know that eventually you want to sell, but that's not front burner right now. What are some of the things that you wish that you could call younger Daryl and say, hey, you need to be thinking this?
Gosh, I think it is having those contracts, that recurring revenue. And that's why you see these software companies selling for such high multiples, is they have 3,000 accounts spending $49.95 a month. I mean, with a low churn rate. And so if you're going to be one of those big creative strategic agencies, that's sometimes a little hard to do, because each month, There is such variation in what your clients need. But I think I would have had more products like that and sold more products like that to our reseller network. So when we did sit down with those interested buyers, that was, you know, because instead of it being project work, which is what they call a lot of this, where you have a 3-month marketing campaign, it's that month-to-month revenue you can count on. Okay. Find some products like that.
That's great. And one thing that strikes me about your career is the continuity of relationships that you've had over so long and how you leverage that into both customers. Well, first, you leverage that into the agency. You leverage that into more partner customers. And then when it came time to sell, that gave the buyer confidence because they knew that you were well-known in that industry. Are there any tips that you can give for agency owners, particularly? I'm a 100% introvert, right? Even though I do this podcast, it's because I'm talking with you, but I'm 100% introvert and I was very bad at that. And I'm sure that it hurt me in the long term. What tips can you give to people about how to think about building that network and nurturing that network for the long haul?
I think a lot of what you're doing right here, Raj, is the whole creating content, putting yourself out there as that subject matter expert. And I was lucky enough to be in the industry a long time before I started the company. And so I did know a lot of folks from conferences and being involved on committees. And it is, at the end of the day, lots of times when you make that sale, it's as much about the revenue and what you've built as the founder or the CEO's personal reputation. And having that comfort level is turned out to be a good thing. And maybe it's just because the way my mom and dad raised me, but it's like, be ethical, work hard, do what you say you're going to do. I mean, it's not rocket science, but there's a lot of wiggly people out there that don't always follow that approach.
Yeah. And I might add, like, you and I are of an older vintage, we'll just say. And a lot of the younger agency folks out there, their relationships seem to be very online and very transactional. And it is, there's a certain depth of relationship that you get when you really connect with someone and understand what their needs are in a sales context and then in a delivery context. And then you get to know them as people, which is one thing that AI is not going to dislodge in the near future. Right. So having those real relationships, yeah, someone can come in and say, hey, I can cut your cost by X percent, but there's a lot that of an asset that a relationship is that people underappreciate.
And that's what I always told our partners. Look, my team, everybody's on the payroll. We're not outsourcing or offshoring our work. These guys work for us. And if I need a project of yours bumped to the top of the line, I can make that happen. It's again, because we have real people working at the agency and they all are laser focused on, got to make these customers happy. At the end of the day, we have two, in this business, we have two customers. We have our white label reseller partner and the end retail client. And so You got to keep both of those. You got to keep the sales folks confident. And then the end client has to be delighted with the work.
Good. Well, Daryl, this has been fantastic. I've learned a lot about your model and where you're going with that, with AI. So if someone wants to reach you, and as you know, I've already sent people to you just to talk about that model. And if someone wants to reach you, just to like understand what that model is, whether they want to deploy it themselves, utilize it somewhere else, or learn about some of your cool AI stuff, where can they find more about you and find you?
We've got a website being built, all the emails being set up. But right now, the best way to reach me is with my Gmail address, dmhively@gmail.com. And fantastic. My phone, you're welcome to call 414-234-8529.
Awesome. Great. Daryl, it was great to have you. Thank you for sharing your wisdom and your experience. And I'll look forward to chatting with you soon.
All right. My pleasure. Thank you for having me.